child. Now he clung to her skirt so closely that he hampered her walking, and she laid her hand on his head and kept it there because she knew that somewhere deep down in his prematurely old mind he lived with fear. They came down onto the sun-dazzled white band of the macadam, and she pushed him on ahead to run with Chester, squared her own shoulders, and stepped out briskly. It would be hard to know what to do with the children when she got well and went back to work, unless they could work out shifts that would let one of them be always at home. With Bruce this way, he couldn't be left alone. But she suspected that he shouldn't be left alone with Beau, either. Beau wouldn't have any patience with his terrors. Maybe Beau could get permission to put an extension onto the café, and they could live there. The lumber company owned the whole town, and they hadn't been able to get any place before, until Mr. Bain at the stage office let them camp on his timber tract. But if they could— "Oh, fiddle," she said. "It will all come out in the wash." At the fork where the sawmill road turned off, she cut across the spongy meadow and entered the dirt road that ran straight as a yardstick through heavy timber. The doctor's office was visible an eighth of a mile down, a little frame shanty that he had put up midway between town and mill, so as to be available to both. Just as she came into the road, a man went into the office door. That meant she would have to wait. She told the boys to play outside. The little waiting room was empty, but the doctor poked his head around the inner door and said, "Good morning. I'll be just a minute." She heard the noise of his moving around inside and the mutter of voices. A high, nasal voice said, "Ow, for Christ's sake!" And the doctor laughed. An instrument clinked in a pan, and after a few minutes the doctor's matter-of-fact voice again, "Leave that bandage on a couple of days and then take it off and put on a clean one. Bake it in the oven if you can't get it sterile any other way. If it shows any signs of infecting, keep a warm, wet pack on it." The patient said nothing. The door opened and he came out, one ear and the side of his face along the temple swathed in bandage. He was a tall, thin man with a peeled-looking skin and a bald head. The doctor, very young and growing a pale mustache to make himself appear older, leaned against the door and looked after him and laughed. "How did he get hurt?" Elsa said. "One ear hanging by a string," the doctor said. "These stiffs come in with some tall stories sometimes, an obvious bullet wound, a nice neat groove that creased his face and tore his ear half off, and he tries to tell me he snagged it on a nail in the dark, getting up to see what some disturbance was." He laughed again. "He'd have to be going 30 miles an hour to do that on a nail." Elsa was staring.
"Do you know him?"
"No. He isn't one of the boys from the camp or the mill, just a bum passing through. Some day he'll get shot and won't come out so lucky."
"Oh, I'm glad," Elsa said.
"Glad?"
"You see," she said, and looked at him so radiantly that he batted his eyes. "You see, I shot him."
"Oh, come on."
"Really? He broke into our shed last night, and I thought he was a cougar."
The doctor leaned out to look up the road. "Do you want him pinched? We could still catch him, probably." She shook her head, and he motioned her into the inner room. "Left-handed?" he said, as he began unwrapping her bandage. "I knew that bum was lucky. If you'd had the use of both hands, he'd be worm's meat now."
Elsa shivered. "That's just what I was afraid of," she said.
Beau was alone in the café when she hurried in, and he leaned his elbows on the counter and winked at the boys. "Hi, kids," he said. "I was just hoping you'd show up."
"Why?"
they said.
"Ice cream tastes funny this morning."
He talked to them man to man, seriously.
"Tastes funny as the dickens for some reason. I need somebody to tell me what's the matter with it."
Chester's droll, eyebrowless face dropped open, and then he leered, scenting a hoax.
"Which kind is it tastes funny?" he said.
"Both. Darndest thing I ever saw. Chocolate tastes funny and vanilla tastes funny. Maybe you can tell me what's wrong with the stuff."
"I can tell quite a lot about chocolate," Chester said.
"Okay. How about you, Brucey?"
"I can tell more about vanilla," Bruce said.
Their father filled two cones and passed them over the counter.
"Taste hard," he said.
and waited, frowning, for their verdict.
"Tastes to me as if they might have got a little skunk juice in them. Taste anything?"
Chester rolled his tongue in his mouth.
"There's a little skunk juice in it, all right."
Bruce was hesitating, not quite sure he wanted any of his.
"By golly," Beau said heartily, "that's just what I thought. Here, I'll throw them in the garbage pail for you."
He reached over the counter. Bruce, hesitating, was about to give his up, but Chester backed away, his eyes big over the suspended cone.
"Don't you want me to throw the nasty thing away?"
Beau said. Chester took a lick, staying cautiously out of reach.
"Aw, you're fooling,"
he said, and ran outside. Bruce followed him, the dubious cone still unlicked in his hand.
"Beau," Elsa said, "guess what I just saw?"
"What?"
"The man I shot at. He was down in the doctor's office with his ear half shot off."
"No fooling."
"Yes, he wasn't hurt bad. He was a hobo," Miles said.
Beau's eyes across the counter were crinkling, the pupils warming.
"Feel better, huh?"
"I should say so."
"Want an ice cream cone to celebrate?"
"All right."
She sat swinging her legs from the high stool, licking the cone, thinking how pleasant it was to drop into your husband's place of business and talk with him and have an ice cream cone, the way she had always wanted to in hard anger when Beau ran the bowling alley.
"I heard something myself this morning," Beau said.
She looked at him. He had taken out his knife and was scraping absent-mindedly at the accumulated grease under the metal edge of the counter. The grease came off in a thin, curling strip.
"Look at that," he said. "You'd think it would be clean, washed as much as it is."
He flipped the curling strip in disgust to the floor. Elsa waited, knowing perfectly well that whatever was on his mind, it was not the grease under the counter edge. After a minute, his eyes came up.
"Ever hear of the Peace River country?"
"Yes," she said slowly. "Isn't that the farming country up in Canada somewhere where people were going from Dakota?"
"Yeah, in Alberta."
Elsa had stopped licking her ice cream cone. As if someone had touched her and pointed, she saw the direction of his thoughts, and her muscles tightened with an instinctive antagonism, almost a fear.
"What about it?" she said.
"Nothing about it," Beau said. "It's a good country, that's all. About the best farm country anywhere, probably."
"Are you wanting to go up there?"
"Nope," Beau said deliberately. "It's all filled up."
He shut his knife and slid it into his pocket.
"But I know a place that's just as good, or better, that hasn't got a soul in it."
"But you're not a farmer."
"I'm not a fry cook either," he said.
"But where is it? Where is this place?"
"In Saskatchewan."
They had been staring at each other over the counter almost as if they were about to quarrel. Now Elsa saw his face lose its dead, expressionless stillness, the light come into his eyes, the animation appear.
"There isn't a thing there but a few cattle ranches," he said. "A fellow that comes in for breakfast lately was telling me. He was up through there 3 or 4 years ago, drifting around, working on ranches, just wide open, big as all outdoors. But they're opening it for homesteaders, see? And the CPR is going to run a branch line down through there from Swift Current. That opens it up. All that land that's as good wheat land as the Peace River country. See what that means?"
Elsa said nothing.
"It means," Beau said, watching her, "that the boys that get in there early and buy up land at the logical town sites are going to make plenty of money. In 10 years, there'll be dozens of towns along that line, and the ones that get in on the ground floor will be sitting pretty."
"I should think Dakota would have soured you on that kind of thing," Elsa said.
"Oh, Dakota," he said. "You don't see the difference. The difference is that this is new, see? It isn't even scratched."
He grew almost violent, trying to show it to her as he saw it.
"Why, God knows what's up there," he said. "There might be coal or iron or oil or any damn thing under that ground. Nobody but cowpunchers and the surveyors have ever been over it, and a railroad coming right through it."
When she still kept silent, he waved a pencil in the air.
Suppose you were up there and homesteaded a quarter section, somewhere along the right-of-way. And suppose you found coal on that quarter, say. Good God, all you'd have to do is snoop around a little and use your bean, and you could buy up all the likely-looking coal land and be on Easy Street in a year.
What would you buy it with? She said, not wanting to say it, not wanting really to throw cold water on his visions, but compelled to say it. They couldn't even afford a wooden house. And here he talked about Easy Street in a country hundreds of miles away, where they would have to start from scratch all over again and might never even get beyond their initial poverty.
She saw the irritated jerk of his head when she said it, but she had to say it, and she had to keep insisting on it, because if she didn't, he would drag them all off to some other get-rich-quick spot, and they'd be back where they had started 7 years ago, or worse.
"You've got about as much imagination as a pancake griddle," he said.
"It isn't a question of imagination," she said steadily. "It's a question of getting along. You can't just leave one place for another without knowing what's going to turn up in the new place. You wouldn't trade a sure thing for a gamble."
"I'd trade this sure thing," Beau said. "I'd trade this joint for almost any gamble you can name."
"And give up all the work we've put into it?"
"Look," he said, "I've been figuring this sure thing out for an hour, and there hasn't been a customer to interrupt me either."
He leaned over with a sheet of paper, but she said defensively, before she would glance down at it,
"It's always dead from 10 to 12. The mealtime crowds hold up.
You'd never get rich off 'em.
You know how much we still owe?"
He stabbed the pencil on a column of figures.
$620.
"But that's pretty good," she said. "That's only half of what it was. We'll have it clear in a year or so."
"And what have we got when we've got it clear?" Beau said. "A business that brings you $100 a month."
"It will be more than that when the payments are all finished."
"And then you'll have to spend that much more renovating."
"But we can live on it," she said. "We've been living on less."
"Out where the cougars sneak around and tramps raid the place and the kids get scared of their shadows," he said. "Do you call that living?"
He looked at the clock, turned to move a kettle onto the fire, took chalk and wrote neatly on the 2x4 blackboard, "Special today, Irish mulligan, bread, coffee, 20 cents, ham and eggs, 20 cents, bacon and eggs, 20 cents, steak and chops on short order." He wrote a clean, neat hand, even on a blackboard.
"I worked on a railroad once," Beau said. "There's plenty of jobs for a smart guy if he keeps his eye open. Like bunkhouses. Sometimes the road puts those up, but lots of times they lease out the concession, and the guy they lease it to gets it straight out of the men's pay. All clean, see? Then when the line moves on, you knock down your bunkhouse and load it on a flat car and set it up further down."
"I shouldn't think there'd be much money in that," she said stonily.
"Well, that shows what you know about it. You know how many men a road has on grading or steel-laying crew? Plenty. 200 or 300. Furnishing bunks for 200 or 300 stiffs isn't chicken feed, even if you flopped 'em for 2 bits a night. And when you're all through in a new country like that, you can sell your beds and chairs and even your bunkhouse to somebody for almost as much as you paid in the first place."
He was tapping with his finger on the counter, watching her. "There's another angle, too. What do you suppose those stiffs do for amusement at night after work? There's no towns to go to. Suppose I wrote Judd to come on along. Don't you suppose a smart gambler like Judd could shake down a little loose change in a place like that? I just guess he could."
"You want to go awfully bad, don't you?" Elsa said.
She felt sad, whipped, dependent. She was a millstone around his neck. That rough new country was where he belonged, really. But it would blow everything she wanted, sky high, uproot her again, take the children into a country where there weren't even schools. Beau was watching her face.
"And you don't," he said.
She shook her head.
"No."
He shrugged and turned to getting things ready for the noon customers, and after a few minutes she went out to gather up the children and take them back for their own lunch. Beau didn't like them around, eating in the cafe. They made it look as if they were eating up the leftovers or something. On Sunday, Elsa was trying to wash clothes behind the tent. Laundry had piled up since she was hurt. Beau needed fresh shirts. The bed linen was soiled. She was sousing shirts in a tub of water and rubbing them one-handed on the board when she heard steps coming around the tent, and for an instant she froze with the fear of another tramp. Then Beau came in sight with his coat over his shoulder and his sleeves rolled up.
"Has something happened?" she said.
"Taking a vacation."
"Why?"
"Why?" he said. "It's about time, isn't it? I've been working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, about long enough."
He seemed mad, sour, out of spirits. And he did need a rest, there wasn't any question.
"Good," she said. "Did you just close up?"
"I made up about 2 dozen sandwiches and put them in a box and left a tin can with a slot in it on the doorstep," he said. "Maybe 1 out of 3 that takes a sandwich will pay for it. I don't give a damn if none of them do."
"Or if somebody steals the can," she said. "I don't either. It's nice to have you home for once. Soon as I get through, maybe we can go for a walk."
He hooked his coat on the clothesline post, throwing it from 6 feet away, took off his shirt and threw it after the coat, and stretched in the sun in his undershirt, a languid, lazy, powerful stretch that moved the muscles under his milky skin. With his dark face and hands, he looked like some odd crossbreed. He pushed her away from the tub.
"You're an invalid," he said. "Let me swing that a while."
"I feel all right. It doesn't hurt."
"Go on," he said,
and she had to back away.
"This is nice," she said. "I wish you could take a vacation more often."
He eyed her obliquely.
"I'd just as soon take a good long vacation from that dump."
Instead of answering, she went inside and got more laundry, and for a while they worked together, he washing and wringing shirts and children's clothes, twisting them so tight with his heavy wrists that she had trouble shaking them out to hang them up. She was standing on tiptoe at the high post end of the line with her mouth full of clothespins when he said,
"Thought any more about that Canada proposition?"
She hung the last shirt and took the clothespins out of her mouth. At this moment, when they were together, comfortable, with the sun on them and the children playing quietly in their own yard, wild enough and poor enough, God knew, but their own, he thought of nothing but getting away.
"Don't be mad, Beau," she said. "You asked me that before, and I told you what I thought. The cafe will keep us. We can clear it and live like other people instead of like gypsies."
"Ugh," Beau said, and scrubbed a nightgown up and down the board. He said no more, but when she got the last batch of scrubbed clothes to hang up, they were twisted as hard as sticks of wood, almost dry enough for ironing. Bruce wandered into sight from the front yard and stood watching. He cocked one foot against his shin, shifted to stand on the other foot.
"Ma," he said, "I gotta go."
Elsa had a sheet halfway on the line, and the wind pulled at it, so she had trouble keeping it in place with one hand.
"You go on by yourself this time," she said over her shoulder. "You can do it."
Bruce shifted his feet, looked solemn, squinted his face, but did not move.
"Go on, bub," Beau said. "Do as your mother tells you. She's busy."
The boy moved a few feet, stopped, put his hands around the pole that supported the line and swung on it. His eyes were on his mother.
"You take me, Ma."
"Go on," his father said. "Ma's busy. You get on out there and back like a man. I bet you a penny you can't be back before I get this water dumped and the tub hung up."
Still watching his mother steadily, Bruce went a few feet, stopped to pick a flower and toss its petals into the air with a jerky little motion. He picked the leaves off the flower stem and did the same with them, very concentrated, very busy. He stood knock-kneed, holding his legs together.
"Now, confound you," his father said sharply. "You move when you're spoken to. Get on out there before I have to make you."
Bruce went slowly out the path, tossing flowers and leaves and sticks into the air with his jerky, invariable motion. At the pile of slashings where the blackberry bushes grew thick, he stopped. His father was hanging up the tub in the shed out of sight. His mother was at the line. But back of him were the bushes, the shadows, and he had to walk another 30 feet into them, alone, to the privy. He didn't like the privy anyway. Wind blew up through the opening at the back, and flies crawled on your behind, and you didn't know what might be down there peeking at you—animals, cougars, snakes, faces with teeth.
Swiftly, he pulled down his overalls and squatted in the weeds beside the path. He had barely ducked when his father's yell startled him to his feet again, scuttling with hands clutching his overalls. But his father was after him. Heavy feet pounded the path. He heard his mother call out, but he couldn't get back to her now. Gasping, he scrambled into the privy and sat up on the children's hole. He cringed back when his father burst in. In one motion, he was yanked upside down and spatted smartly on his bare backside. "Now," his father said, and slammed him back on the hole. "Now you sit there till you're through, and don't let me catch you squatting in the yard again." Bruce bawled, and seeing his mother's face at the door, bawled louder. But his father just went out and shut the door on him, and he heard their steps going away.
"He's frightened," Elsa said. "That's why he doesn't like to come out here."
"Seems to me he's frightened of every damn thing in the world," Beau said. "You can't let him make a pig pen of the yard."
Elsa stopped. "I think I'll stay here and walk back with him," she said. "You've no idea how—"
Beau took her arm. "Let him walk back by himself."
"But he's scared, Beau."
"I was scared of water when I was a kid, too," Beau said. "That didn't keep my old man from throwing me in when I was about 5, where it was 10 feet deep."
"You never liked your father, either. You'll have that child hating you like poison."
"Then he'll just have to hate me," Beau said. "He's got to be trained if I have to bust his head for him on the way."
"You can't whip a child out of being afraid," she said in anger. "Bruce is sensitive, that's all. He's the most sensitive child I ever saw. But he's stubborn as a mule, too, just as stubborn as you are. You'll start something you can't finish."
"Let him keep on being stubborn," Beau said. "I'll guarantee to knock that out of him."
Still angry, she went back and finished hanging up the clothes. But after Bruce came back, sniffling, and Beau had started to putter in the shade of the shed, his jaw still set and a look on his face as if something smoldered in him, she didn't need to ask herself if his rage at Bruce had anything to do with the thing that had been on his mind when he closed up the café and came home for the afternoon. The proposition he had mentioned, glancing at her sideways, and then shut up about when she showed that her mind was still made up the other way. Certainly, in the 2 weeks that followed, he showed less and less interest in the café. He always seemed to get there late in the morning. He closed up earlier at night. He shut up the whole place the following Sunday afternoon and made her come home when she said she would just as soon stay and take care of it. She was taking her regular turn now, relieving him at 11 o'clock and staying till the evening meal was ready. And while she was at the café, he was at home with the boys. That, she knew before 2 days had passed, wasn't good. When she was at home, she could take Bruce out to the privy, look after him, soothe his fears, get him interested in something else. But Beau was a martinet. The kid had been babied too much. All right, he would fix that. He made Bruce dress himself in the mornings, feed his rabbit by himself, without even Chester's help, go out and back by himself, wash himself alone before meals. He insisted that Bruce eat exactly what was set before him and clean up his plate. If he didn't, it was taken away and he went hungry. When he went a whole day stubbornly without eating a mouthful, Elsa protested. Beau was being altogether too hard. It wasn't Bruce's fault. He was finicky. The boys had been moved around from pillar to post ever since they were born. They weren't sure of anything. They had never had a home. You couldn't blame a child for feeling afraid and insecure. But her argument got her nowhere. "Look at Chester," Beau said. "He hadn't had any different kind of life, and look at him. He wasn't afraid of anything. She had babied Bruce till he knew he could get anything he wanted just by whining. Well, he would find out different."
"But he isn't even 4 years old yet," Elsa said, knowing with a kind of panic that she couldn't budge him.
She could see him day by day getting further into that mood of restless irritability, of sullen, stubborn dissatisfaction that had made the last months at Indian Falls a nightmare. Only this time it seemed it was to be Bruce and not the cat who suffered for it. The first result of Beau's discipline was that Bruce began wetting and soiling himself rather than go out to the privy, though he had been broken of wetting for over a year. That only made things worse. If Beau were at the café, she could keep the accidents quiet. But once, when it happened during her shift, She came home to find the child sniffling against the back wall of the shed, and when she undressed him for bed, she found the marks on his buttocks. Bo had used the razor strop on him. That made her shout at him. "You can't spank a child into being dry. Haven't you any sense at all?" He looked at her heavily.
"Can't you see why he does it?"
"He does it because you've got him so scared he's half out of his mind."
"I can see pretty well," he said, "and that isn't what I see. He's doing it to dare me, by God."
"Oh, Bo," she said in despair, "you were so nice to them for a while, and they got along so well. Why don't you try being kind?"
"Sir, I'll be kind when he learns to do what he's told. Let him run over you, and he'll run over you all his life. But by God, he doesn't run over me."
The words fell with solid, whacking emphasis, like chunks being chopped from a straight-grained block. There was nothing she could do, unless she wanted to yield to what she knew bothered him and take the children up into a place where heaven knew what would turn up. So she kept quiet. But when, a few minutes later, she heard him say, "Well, I guess I'll go at one," and saw him take the deck of cards from the bureau and sit down, she wanted to scream. Solitaire was almost worse than bad temper. On a Saturday, 2 weeks after Bo had first closed the cafe for the Sunday afternoon holiday, he came home at 10:30 in the morning. There was a barbecue over at the mill. Not a chance for a customer all day, he said. He seemed in a good enough humor, but restless. For a while, he stood in the yard looking distastefully at the littered clearing. Then he called the boys and started them picking up chips and scraps of paper, piling tin cans over against the woods, straightening up the scattered woodpile. They did it lackadaisically, without thoroughness, but he didn't scold them. After a while, he got hammer and nails and started repairing the porch.
"What's all the cleaning up about?" Elsa asked.
"Well, hell, place looks like a boar's nest. If we got to live here the rest of our lives, I might as well straighten it up a little."
Impulsively, she put her fingers down and stirred his black hair.
"Poor Bo," she said.
"Don't want to change your mind about Canada, do you?" he said. He hammered in a nail with four quick blows. "I had a letter about it the other day."
"Who from?"
"Friend of this Massey that told me about it in the first place. I wrote him and asked for the dope."
"What did he say?"
"Said the road was coming through all right. Already started grading."
For a moment, she was almost tempted. It might be better. There might be a home there. Certainly Bo would be happier if she didn't hold him back. After the way the Alaska business had fizzled, so that now Judd was still right where he had been at first, dealing in a gambling house, and after the way Bo had given up what had looked like a golden chance because of her and the boys when Chester got sick, maybe she ought to say yes. But then her own desires would have to be sacrificed again, and the home she wanted for the children's salvation, for her own salvation, interposed itself like a fence. She said,
"If it weren't for the kids, I'd say go anywhere."
He went on nailing down the loose boards of the porch, and when he had finished that, he got up without a word and went to look at the well cover, which had rotted away at one side. He said nothing more about Canada, but she watched him unhappily, knowing that he was trying to do as she wished, and trying to accept the responsibility that his family laid on him, but that he still must feel chained and trapped. Even after supper he did not mention the subject. He made an effort to be cheerful, creaking back in his chair with his pipe in his mouth and clipping Chester's ear with a backhanded cuff.
"Ow!"
Chester said. He held his ear and scowled.
"Come on and fight," Bo said. "Anybody hits me, I hit him back. What's holding you?"
Chester lowered his head and sailed in, and Bo let him flail a few times before he clipped him on the other ear. As they scuffled, he got hold of Chester's wrist and bent it back, poking the tight little fist into its owner's eye.
"What you hitting yourself for?" he said. "Hit me! It isn't good sense to sock yourself."
Chester squirmed and swung with the other hand.
"You're doing it," he said. "Let go and I'll—"
At the other end of the table, Bruce sidled up to his mother, his eyes fixed steadily on the scuffling, and pulled her dress. She glanced down, saw his lips frame the words, "I got to go."
Her quick glance showed Beau still sparring with Chester, grinning, pushing the boy away with a big, irremovable hand, holding him by the top of the head while Chester tried to bore in. She nodded at Bruce and led him quietly toward the door. Behind her, Beau's voice came heavy and even. "Hey, where are you going?" She turned around with a lie on her very lips before the absurdity of lying about such a thing made her meet his eyes.
"Bruce has to go."
"Let him go by himself." Beau had quit sparring and was holding the still belligerent Chester at arm's length.
"It's getting dark," Elsa said.
"It isn't dark yet by a damn sight," Beau said. "He's been told often enough to go by himself. You just make him worse trying to sneak around and outfox me."
Rebellious and angry, she hesitated. To stand around arguing about such a ridiculous thing? Why shouldn't she go out with him, if it made him feel safer? Why should he have to go out there alone when he was terrified of the woods and the dark? But Beau sat there, implacable and dominating, and that afternoon she had refused for the third time to do the thing he wanted. If this kept on, they would be at loggerheads over every little thing.
"You can go out yourself like a big boy," she said. "Sure you can. Mommy's got to do up the dishes."
She hated herself for that lame surrender, and saw Bruce hating her for it, too. He twitched away from the door and tried putting his fingers around the lantern base.
"I don't need to," he said sullenly.
She looked helplessly at Bruce, then at Beau, and started clearing off the table without a word. But Beau half rose, and his voice was edged with a threat. "Oh, yes, you do. Skin on out there right now." Bruce's lip jutted. His eyes were dark with rebellion.
"I don't need to."
The stool scraped as Beau stood up. "If you want a good hiding," he said, "just stand around there a minute more, seeing how far you can go." The child lingered at the door, his round baby face clouded with passion, but when Beau took two swift, heavy steps toward him, he bolted. Elsa said nothing. If Beau wanted to make that issue the most important in the world just to assure himself that he was boss, she supposed he would do it. Bruce was trying enough. He made you want to scream sometimes, but it did no good to bully and spank. That only made the trouble loom bigger, and it was already ridiculously exaggerated. Let Beau go on and earn the hatred of his son. Secretly, she would almost have bet on the child rather than on Beau. Bruce would take scoldings, spankings, brutality, anything, and wail and howl and cry, but they wouldn't break him. All they would do would be to harden him under the surface fear and callous him to punishment. The door opened, and Bruce slipped in quickly. He shut the door as if locking something out. Beau took his pipe from his mouth and looked at him, the faint expression of petulance on his face overlaid by surface hardiness. "Get your business done?"
"Yes."
"Weren't any boogers out there either, were there?"
"No."
"Sure not," Beau said. "Not a booger in sight. Even if there was, there's no call for a big guy like you to be scared. Chet here eats boogers for breakfast." When he turned his chair squarely and fronted the child, his face to his wife was a curious mixture, as if the bluff, good-natured heartiness with which he treated the children sometimes, and which he was trying to assume now, were an expression worn over at least two others, as if the underlying muscles of his face said at the same time that he was doomed and damned and leg-ironed by family responsibilities, and as if the eyes quite independently were appraising his youngest with an acid, prying look of contempt. But his voice was the playful voice of teasing fellowship. "Come on over and get pasted," he said. "I just toughened Chet up till you couldn't drive a nail in him." Bruce hung close to his mother by the stove, his eyes sullen and unyielding.
"I don't want to," he said.
The look of contempt for a moment obliterated the other expressions on Beau's face. He looked at Elsa, laughed a short, hard laugh, and stood up. "All right," he said. "All right, all right, you don't want to." As he passed the stove on his way out of the tent, Bruce crowded back against the box where his mother kept the dishes,
and his eyes followed his father until the door shut behind him. Elsa sighed.
"You ought to play when Pa wants you to," she said.
But Bruce turned his head aside and picked slivers off a stick of firewood with ritualistic care.
"I don't want to,"
he said again.
"If you minded the first time he spoke to you, you wouldn't get into trouble," she said. "Can't you try to mind better, Brucie?"
He went on picking slivers, and she turned from him to get out the dishes. After a few minutes, she heard Beau's steps coming up the path along the side of the tent. There was a surprised grunt. The footsteps paused while she might have counted five. Then Beau's voice, strident, high-pitched, insane with rage, was shouting curses. The baby jerked from behind the stove as if he were going to run, but in the middle of the tent he hesitated, his head swinging like a cornered animal's, and his eyeballs distended with terror. Elsa had barely time to gather him in close to her before Beau burst in the door. In the flash, while their eyes met and held, while she crowded Bruce behind her back protectively, she knew that she had never seen Beau so furious. His face and neck were swollen and dark, his eyes glaring, his breath panting between bared and gritted teeth. His voice came in an incoherent, snarling roar.
"Of all the goddamn, right beside the path where I step in it and lie about it, right beside the path and then lie about it!"
He was crouched on the threshold as if about to spring, and she backed up a step, holding Bruce behind her.
"Beau, for God's sake, keep your temper, Beau!"
The swiftness with which his big body moved paralyzed her for a split second with utter terror that he would kill the child. Before she could put up her arm, he had caught her shoulder and pushed her aside, and she fell screaming, trying with both hands to hang on to Bruce, feeling his fingers torn loose from her dress even while she fell, and hearing his thin squeak of terror. She screamed,
"Beau! Oh, my God! Beau! Beau!"
Moving with the same silent, terrible speed, he was out the door again with Bruce under his arm, and she scrambled up, silent herself now, to hurl herself after him. Around the side of the tent, the child's idiot babble of fear rose to a shriek, broke, rose again, cackled in a mad parody of laughter. In the near dark, she saw Beau bending over, the baby's frantic kicking legs beating out behind him as he shoved the child's face down to the ground, rubbing it around.
"Will you mind?" he kept saying. "Will you mind now, you damn stubborn little—"
She pulled at him, clawing, but one thick arm, powerful as a hurled log, brushed backward and knocked her down again, and she fell sideways on her half-healed arm. She never even felt the pain. Her mouth worked over soundless words. Like a dog, she screamed at him without making a sound.
"You treat your child like a dog!"
Her legs kicked her to her feet again so quickly that she might never have fallen. Beau was still rubbing Bruce's nose into the ground in a savage prolongation of fury. Hatred flamed in her like a sheet of light. She wanted to kill him. Somehow her hand found a stick of stove wood in it, and with murder in her heart she rushed him. The first blow fell solid and soft across his shoulder. The second stung her hand as it found hard bone. Then she was wrestling with him, sobbing, trying to hit him again, screaming with helplessness and fury, when she felt her wrist bent backward and her fingers loosening on the club. Now, finally, the long moment when the madness burned out of both of them as suddenly as it had come, and they faced each other in the heavy forest twilight, with Bruce sobbing on the ground between them, and Chester terrified and whimpering at the corner of the tent. Beau stared at her stupidly, his hands hanging. In the dusk she saw his mouth work, and bit her own lip, her body weak as water, and her burned arm one long hammering ache. She didn't speak. Gathering the threads of her strength, she stooped and picked up Bruce and carried him into the tent, motioning Chester in after her and bolting the door. Without pause or thought, she went straight to the bed and lay down with Bruce tight against her, holding his moaning into her breast and trying by the very rigidity of her embrace to stop the shudders that went through his body. While she lay there, Chester crept against her so that she rolled a little and put her burned hand clumsily on his head. There was no sound outside the tent. She caught herself listening tensely, and the anger touched her again like a rod of bare, icy metal. The shivering of the child in her arms lessened gradually, but his breath still shook him into shudders, and at every catching intake of air she held him fiercely, like a dog, expecting a child to learn all at once, to be told and never afterward make a mistake, never to have any feelings of his own, but to jump like a trained animal. Even a dog he treated better, lessened with endless patience, rewarded when it did something right. She blinked her dry eyes, scratchy as if they had been blown full of sand.
"Poor child," she said. "Poor baby."
Her hand rubbed up and down his back, and she whispered in his ear,
"Don't cry. Don't cry, baby. We won't let him do it any more."
What instant outrage that she should have to say such a thing to him. "We won't let him do it any more. His father."
"Are you all right now?" she said, finally. "Will you lie here and rest while Mommy lights the lamp?"
His hands clung, and she lay back.
"Chet," she said, "can you light the lamp, do you think?"
He slipped off the bed, and she heard him bump against the table in the dark. Light leaped in a feeble spurt, went out, and he struck another match. Then the steadying glow of the lamp as he brought it back to the bed in both hands, carefully.
"Good boy," she said. "Set it on the chair."
Sitting up, she smoothed Bruce's hair back from his forehead and looked at him, and the cry that was wrenched from her came from a deeper well of horror and shame and anger than even the blows she had rained on Beau outside. Bruce's face was smeared with dirt and excrement and tears. Under that filth he was white as a corpse, his face shrunken and sharpened with terror. A nerve high in his cheek twitched in tiny, sharp spasms, and his whole head shook as if he had St. Vitus's dance. But his eyes...
"Look at me," she said harshly, and shook him. "Brucey, look at me."
The mouth closed on a thin, bubbling wail. The cheek twitched, but the eyes did not change. They remained fixed in mute, impossible anguish, twisted inward until the pupils were half lost in the inner corners.
"Ma," Chester said, "is he cross-eyed, Ma?"
He began to cry. She shook Bruce again, her own eyes blind.
"Bruce!"
His cheek twitched and his body shuddered.
"Get me a pan of water and a washcloth,"
Elsa said to Chester. She said it quietly, holding her voice down, as if throwing all her weight on it. He mustn't be frightened any more. She mustn't shout at him. She must be soothing, soft, safe. Holding him cradled against her bad arm, she washed his face gently with the cloth, ran it over his eyes, pressed it against his forehead under the silky light hair matted with sweat and filth. Minute by interminable minute she washed him, and heard the sobbing smooth out under the stroking, saw the cheek twitch less often, less violently. Chester was putting wood in the stove, being helpful, his solemn, teary face watching his mother and brother on the bed. Elsa took a firm hold on Bruce's shoulders.
"Look, Brucey," she said. "Look at Chet over there, getting supper for us like a big man."
While she watched, not breathing, Bruce's eyes wavered, rolled outward from that fixed and inhuman paralysis. Some of the glaring white eyeballs, streaked with red, slid back out of sight, and the whole pupils appeared briefly. Then, as if the strain were too much, as if normal focus were an effort too great for more than a moment, the pupils rolled back again. Elsa caught her breath with a jerky sigh.
"Maybe tomorrow, after he had slept." "But, oh God," she said, "to treat a child that way!"
She had just laid him down on the pillow and started to get something to eat for Chester, when Bruce was screaming again, eyes frantically crossed and cheek twitching, his hands clawing at his face and his voice screaming, "Mama, Mama, on my face, on my nose!"
Chapter 5
There hadn't really been any decision. As she dragged the round-topped trunk up the steps and propped its lid against the table, she was thinking that you never really made up your mind to anything. You simply bent where the pressure was greatest. You didn't surrender because surrender was annihilation, but you gave before the pressure. A light rain fingered the canvas over her head, and she knew the move would be unpleasant, sodden, miserable, but it didn't matter greatly. To leave on a sunny day would be inappropriate. A retreat should be made in weather as miserable as the act itself. There wasn't much to pack. Beau's clothing she stowed in his brown suitcase and put aside. That could be left at the hotel for him, in case he ever came back. Apart from that, there were only her own few clothes, the children's things, the bedding and table linen. Mr. Bain would have whatever else the tent contained, stove, beds, table, bureau, dishes. Mr. Bain had been very kind. He didn't really want the things at all. It was only to help her that he bought them. Oh, and the rabbits. She straightened, brushing back the hair that fell damply on her forehead. What to do with the rabbits? They couldn't be left, and they could hardly be taken to a boarding-house room in Seattle. She shrugged and gave up thinking about them almost before she had begun. They could be taken a long part way, perhaps given to someone along the road. Any child would be glad to get them. Chester staggered in with a quilt huddled against his chest, dragging in front so that he tripped on it. Bruce came after him, also loaded. They were excited. The move to them was adventure. They didn't know it was retreat.
"What else, Ma?" Chester said.
"You'd better go feed your bunnies," she said. "There's some carrots in the shed." 2 minutes later they were back, breathless.
"Ma, the bunnies are gone!"
"Are you sure? The pen's empty." She went to look. The screen had rusted away at one side of the board floor of the hutch, and something, either the rabbits or something digging from outside, had widened the hole. The boys looked up at her, and she hid her feeling of relief. She had to appear to be sorry.
"Why don't you look around the edge of the brush?" she said. "They're tame. They'd stay around. Take the carrots and call them."
She went back into the tent and packed the remaining things. In the bureau drawer, back under a collection of odd stockings, she found the tintype of her mother, stood looking at it a moment, curiously, emotionless, emptied, unable to remember somehow the way she had used to feel when looking at that portrait. She snapped the case shut and laid it in the trunk. She heard the buckboard come into the clearing and went to the door. Emil Herla, one of the bus drivers who lived in Richmond, waved from the seat.
"I'm practically ready," she said. "The trunk's packed now if you want to get it."
Herla, a great lumbering man with a gray, pockmarked face, climbed down and got the trunk, muscling it through the door on his thighs. Elsa hurriedly crammed the last rags into her telescope and crushed it shut, strapping it tight. Herla came in and took it off the table. She looked around at the striped beds, the empty bureau with its drawers hanging open, the trash littered on the floor, discarded socks, frayed collars, hoarded mop rags, all the souvenirs of flight. Deliberately, under a compulsion that was more than her ingrained neatness, that was something like a defiance in the midst of panic, she took the stubby broom and swept the whole place, dumping the refuse in the stove and setting fire to it. The boys and Herla stood in the door and watched her.
"Our bunnies got lost," Chester said.
Herla put his hands on his knees and bent down.
"Is that right now?" he said. "That's too bad."
"They got out of the pen," Chester said. "We hunted, but we can't find them."
"Well, now," Herla said, "maybe we ought to look once more."
He lifted his eyes to Elsa as if to ask if they had time, and when she nodded, he went out, the boys after him. She had pulled out the beds and swept up the dust puppies and had stood the broom back of the stove. When she heard Bruce crying, she went to the door. Herla stood with the well cover lifted on edge, and all three were looking down in.
"Ma!"
Chester shouted. "Ma, the bunnies are down there!"
Slowly she went out through the drizzle, her feet sinking soggily in the wet mold, the rain like fine mist in her face. At the well edge she stopped and peered. 10 feet down, floating whitely, close together, their fur spread by the water like the fur of an angry cat, were the rabbits. The holes under the cover, she supposed, had tempted them in.
"Get a rope!" Chester shouted. "Get something! We got to get them out!"
The sight of Bruce's immense, teary eyes as she turned away made Elsa grit her teeth with momentary fury, as if he were to blame. Then she pulled him against her and took Chester's hand.
"It's no use," she said. "Your bunnies are drowned. It's a shame." "But we can't leave them in there," Chester said. "Ma!"
She drew them away. Herla let the cover fall, and Bruce burst out in a wild, passionate wail. She lifted him into the buggy, letting him cry, ignoring Chester's worried,
"Ma, we can't! Ma!"
Herla climbed up and took the lines. The mist had powdered the wool of his cap like a thin coating of flour. He sawed the team around and started out of the clearing. Elsa ducked her head to avoid the first low branches of the old tote road. She did not look back, but she could see in her mind every bush and stump in the clearing, every stain on the canvas roof, every detail of the place that had been home for a year and a half, that had still been home even after Beau ran off to Canada, that she had been fiercely determined to make home. But it was too much, she thought. She couldn't have tried any harder. Behind her she heard Bruce's crying, furious now because she had not comforted him, and she felt in Chester's silence his grief for the death they left behind them in the well. She couldn't blame them any more than she could help them. There was too much that lay dead behind her. That well and clearing and abandoned tent house, neatly swept and locked against intrusion, was a gravestone in her life. There had been other gravestones, but this was the worst, because it was more than a hope or a home that lay dead there. It was her marriage. Though she had not admitted it before, she knew that one reason she had tried so hard to keep the cafe going and to hold to the clearing was the hope that some day Beau would come back. She did not look behind her, but she knew exactly how Bruce and Chester felt when they knelt at the lip of the well and saw the white, furred-out shapes of their pets floating, lifting motionless to the motionless lifting of earthbound water in a dark, earth-smelling hole under the rain. Part 3 Chapter 1 Beau came out of the half-diamond bar bunkhouse with Bighorn, the foreman, and stood picking his teeth in the watery October sun. Rusty, third son of a British earl, was stapling a broken bridle at the corner of the house. Another remittance man, the boy they called Slivers, was sprawled against the horse corral playing his mouth organ. Louis Treat, a half-breed Assiniboine, lounged against a low, rock-weighted stack of prairie hay and braided at a horsehair rope. 100 yards up through the light, leafless growth of black birch and cottonwood, the stone mansion of Jim Purcell showed. Beau spat on the ground. "How much money has old Purcell got, anyway?" he said. Bighorn shrugged.
"He's loaded with it. He gives a CPR every other house lot to survey a town site here, and even if he'd have give 'em 9/10 of it, it'd still have been a good proposition for him."
"How many head of cattle does he run?"
"About 8,000.
"He'll have to cut that out, though, when the range gets homesteaded."
"Hell, he don't care about that," Bighorn said. "He must own 40,000 acres up the river. He was smart. He was buying land long before the road started down through."
"You got to hand it to him," Beau said. "Still, he had the breaks, too."
Bighorn turned on him and laughed.
"What's the matter? You sore because you didn't think of it first?"
"I wasn't on the ground," Beau said. "That makes a hell of a lot of difference."
"Hell, if I had your bunkhouse business, I wouldn't kick."
"I'm not kicking," Beau said. "I'm just wishing Purcell had left a little cream for the rest of us. That bunkhouse business won't last forever."
"Give you a job, 30 a month and grub," Bighorn said. "Christ almighty, what if you had to work? How'd you like riding line in a 40-below blizzard?"
"I told you I wasn't kicking," Bo said. "I'm just trying to figure some way a man could make a good thing out of this town Purcell's got started. There isn't much doubt it's going to be a town."
"Oh, it'll be a town, all right."
"Look at that Syrian peddler that's squatted here," Bo said. "Those guys are smart. They don't settle any place unless they see money in it."
"Tell me the Grain Growers Association's going to build an elevator,"
Bighorn said.
"Sure it'll be a town."
"There isn't anything it hasn't got," Bo said. "All that flat between the bends, that's plenty of room to grow in. Hills full of lignite, plenty of water. Hell, it'll draw trade for 30 miles around."
"Big as Chicago in 10 years,
Bighorn said comfortably. He yawned.
"When it gets about as big as Shaunavon, I'm moving on. You and the rest of the promoters can run it then."
"Kiss my ass," Bo said. "You're scared it'll get big enough to support a cop."
"Cops don't bother me," Bighorn said. "Not Canadian cops. They're putting more Mounties at the post this winter, did you know that?"
"Sure."
"Sure. Heard the old man talking about it the other day."
"Then that settles it," Bo said. "They aren't sticking in any new Mounties unless they're sure the place is going to grow." He looked through the trees at Purcell's stone house. There was the guy that had used his bean, gathered everything all into himself. Stone house, 40,000-acre ranch, 8,000 head of cattle, real estate to hell and gone, chink house boy, big shots stopping in on the stage all the time to talk to him. "By God," he said, "I wish I owned about 20 lots in the middle of that flat." Bighorn yawned.
"It must be uncomfortable to be ambitious," he said. "Jasper's gnawing at your pants all the time. Why don't you leave all that ambition to the guys with a pack of kids to raise?"
Bo looked at him. "Maybe I have got a pack of kids to raise."
"Maybe you have," Bighorn said. "How would I know?"
Two cowpunchers, Slip and Littlehorn, came across the open space between the saddle shed and the corral and stopped to listen to Slivers blow on his mouth organ. He was playing something sad and shivery, flapping his fingers to get a tremolo. Out of nowhere, apparently, a small boy appeared, a dark, black-eyed boy of about 8, with a dark birthmark on the very end of his nose. Littlehorn said something to him, and he looked up with an impish, white-toothed smile.
"That's Cerulean's kid, one of them," Bighorn said. "He's the guy with a pack of them. Must have 6 or 7.
"He'll raise them, too," Bo said. "I never saw a Syrian yet that couldn't make money if there was any to be made."
"There you go again," said Bighorn. "Why in hell don't you open a grocery store if you think it's such a good thing?"
"I'm after something better than grocery stores." The Arulian boy cackled loudly at something one of the hands said. Littlehorn put his hand on the boy's head, and the boy ducked away with a scornful mouth. Littlehorn laughed and started away toward the corral, half hidden behind the saddle shed. In 3 minutes he was back, dragging a lassoed calf, hauling it along with an upturned muzzle and braced legs. The Arulian boy stood and watched. So did Bo and Bighorn. Littlehorn went and brought an old saddle girth, threw the calf, and fastened it around him like a surcingle. The calf blatted, and Littlehorn led it up, holding it by the ears.
"Okay, cowboy, let's see you ride him."
The boy approached carefully, sidling, hesitated as the calf backed away, tried to get around to the side. Slip braced himself against the calf's haunches, and Littlehorn held its head.
"Climb aboard, cowboy," Littlehorn said.
The boy leaned across the calf's back and scrambled and kicked himself up. His eyes were enormous, and he hung tightly to the surcingle. The two punchers jumped back and yelled, and the calf went pitching across the lot. The boy hung on for about 3 jumps before he sprawled headlong. For a moment he lay where he fell while the calf bucked off toward the river. Then he pushed himself up from the ground with his mouth drawn down in a tough leer. Littlehorn, before he went after the calf, shook his hand and said he'd stayed 60 seconds. Then Slip shook his hand, then Slivers. The boy was pretty proud.
"Pretty tough kid," Bo said.
Abruptly he threw away his toothpick and pulled down his hat.
"Guess I'd better go see if my chink has burned up the joint," he said, and walked away.
It was some time before he could shake out of his head the memory of the way Chet used to swagger and leer when he had done something he thought he ought to be proud of. Chet was a good kid, full of beans. He'd be just about the Aurelian kid's age now, maybe a little younger. He walked across the mouth of the East Bend, cut through a straggly patch of willows, and came out on the flat where the town would be. There were already three bare frame shacks and two derailed dining cars set up along what would eventually be a street. The raw earth where the scrapers had been working showed against the foot of the south hill,